From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made by way of the Philippines and Egypt, and then in California. It's the story of two immigrants seeking the American dream and their daughter, who became it. Malika Garib is a deputy editor at NPR. She grew up in Cerritos, California, with her Filipina mother and Egyptian father. She says her childhood was one of navigating several cultures and identities, where she was often asked at school, "What are you?" Garib says she found it a difficult question to answer at times. She writes in one passage, quote, "I eat rice every day and I went to Catholic high school, but my dad is a Muslim who lives in Egypt. I spend my summers with him. I can understand Tagalog and Arabic, so I guess both. Well, I feel kind of more Filipino because that's who I spent more time with," end quote. That's just one passage from her graphic novel, I Was Their American Dream. The book is her Egyptian-Filipino-American coming-of-age story. It explores her multicultural identity and how she felt she had to adapt to different traditions, languages, and religions with the different people in her life. It's a sentiment shared by many first-generation Americans, including her friend, Nguyen Coi Nguyen, a Vietnamese-American who is sharing his story in his own forthcoming book, The Gulf. Both Garib and Nguyen join us this hour to talk about the themes of identity and multiculturalism and to discuss what it means to be a first-generation American, especially in 2020. And I have to say, I Was Their American Dream is showing up on a lot of lists of books you ought to read. It's one of the most thoughtful and open explorations of identity that I have come across in a long time. So Malika Garib, congratulations on this book, and thank you for being here to share your story.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much for the kind introduction.
And Nguyen Coi Nguyen, author of The Gulf and Bittersweet, a pandemic sketchbook and a digital media lecture at Loyola University of Maryland. Nguyen, I was working so hard to make sure I was going to pronounce your name correctly, and then you told us just to say Nguyen. So welcome. How are you?
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, I got you off the hook there.
No, you don't have to take me off the hook. There's even a section of the book, the forthcoming book, where there's a whole thing on how to spell and pronounce it. Do you want to give me a quick tutorial, or do you want to stick with Nguyen?
Well, okay, so since you asked, and thank you for asking and taking the time, it's how it was described to me to explain it is there's that NG sound as if you were saying bang. So you start off the word with that NG, mm-hmm. and then the U-Y-E-N really throws people, but it really is just like a W sound, wing. So it's NG plus that, so it's wing.
Nguyen, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, I want you to know that if I roll over it too fast and say a more Americanized Nguyen, it's not out of disrespect, but I'm happy to work
on. No, that's fine.
And thank you both for being with us. Malika, I want to start with you and really I want to start with why you wrote this graphic memoir. In a previous interview, you talked about how 2016 maybe motivated you to look more deeply at identity, to think about it in different ways. And I know that you use art in many ways to kind of find expressive voices. Take me through what convinced you to write this and put this together now.
Sure. Yeah. So as you said, it was 2016, and I just kept seeing all this stuff in the media and in like the zeitgeist about immigrants and how, you know, they're just dying to get into this country and they're going to take our jobs. And like the stuff that I heard from after 9/11 about Muslim people, about how, that, you know, Muslim people are terrorists. And like, it just like really like I think I was old enough to say to myself, wait a second, like, what is happening? And I thought to myself, maybe this is a good time for me to share what it was like growing up in a really, really diverse part of the country where that experience of living in an Asian bubble where everybody around me was, you know, Korean, Filipino, Chinese, a lot of Hispanic people, that was my normal in America. And I wanted to just sort of share that and express that with other people. And I started drawing cartoons because I thought that, you know, this is the way that everybody at that time was like doing something political. They were fundraising. What were they doing? They were like, you know, advocating for Planned Parenthood, doing different things at the time. And I thought, maybe I'll just draw, this feels true to me. I'm going to draw comics about the immigrant experience in America, and hopefully that resonates with people. And geez, it really did. I would draw a cartoon about, you know, my dad, the Muslim who America fears. And, you know, the cartoon has stuff like, he loves Kentucky Fried Chicken. He loves gardening. He loves, you know, he loves, like, what does he love? He loves, like, Tom Hanks. And so many people in the Muslim community were like, oh, my God, my dad, too. Like, my dad's a total nerd. Like, he's, like, so harmless. And I felt like, maybe there's something here. And I just kept going and going and making these cartoons. And actually, the deeper that I started drawing, the more I started drawing, the more I realized, like, I have so many questions. Like, A, why have I never thought of this until now? Why did it take, like, a presidential election for me to think about this? B, maybe, why was I trying so hard to be white? And that really was, like, the driving factors of, like, the entire book, basically.
I think there are so many interesting sections as your life progressed through school to college into the working world, and I want to talk about that as well. But let me also ask, Nguyen, if you want to talk a little bit about what the Gulf is about, and let our listeners know what you're aiming to do with this particular work.
Yeah, so this is a graphic novel I've been working on for way too long, for about 7 years or so, and it started off because I fell in love with graphic novels as an adult. You know, as a kid, I was really into superhero comics like X-Men and Spider-Man. But then I went to art school, and then they sort of tell you that is not sophisticated enough, and you get into being a studio artist. But I realized with the work that I was seeing from Alison Bechdel and Adrian Tamina and others that, wow, this is an incredible art form that actually maybe I have something to contribute to. So I started just drawing these fictionalized stories about my family, and because that's what I know. And I just felt like there were these, the heroes that I had in the comic world, they just closely observed what was going on in their world, right? And that's what I wanted to do. And I didn't see other Vietnamese American artists doing that in the comics realm, and so I thought, you know, maybe I do have something original to say. And you know, seven years later, I'm five chapters in, and I do feel like I'm figuring out, and it's starting to make sense.
Okay, well, are you finding yourself doing this kind of work that is beneficial to yourself, or is it really aimed at helping a broader audience understand things differently?
I think it, for me, it has to start with, like, how do I just entertain myself, and how do I keep challenging myself and make work that I can be proud of, that I would want to read? And I feel like usually if I achieve that, then an audience will come out of that. So I don't try to just focus on the audience. That's not my main priority. Is just to make work that I'm really proud of.
What do you make of the success and the interest in Malika's work?
Oh, I mean, Malika just blows me away. And when I read her comic, I just thought, wow, it resonates so much. And I think what a lot of people get out of it is that there are these little things that we all share, this common experience, this immigrant experience. And even if you're not a first-generation immigrant, you know, you have grandparents that came to this country, you know, that have told you stories, or, you know, that we all came from somewhere. And, you know, out of the specific comes the universal, and that's definitely these details that Malika comes up with are just so... They really just touch me every time I read her work. And incidentally, I teach a comics class, and Malika came to the class through Zoom, I think, 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And all the students loved reading her comic, and we spent a whole class period talking about her work, and they asked her tons of questions, and she's really gracious.
Easily digestible, but it's really, really thoughtful. Go ahead, Malika. I know you want to jump in there. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say one thing that I really love about Wynn's work is that he's doing something that is really, really necessary, which is like sharing the joy and sharing the joy of our culture. I feel like there just needs to be more spaces and voices and stories of young people in this country who actually love coming from their culture and like just want to express it in a way that feels comfortable. And like, we're kind of not taught to be ourselves. And, you know, through Wynn's stories, talking about traditions, Vietnamese, like what it's like growing up in a regular family, it just like really, I think, allows the reader to feel like, you know, maybe I should like bring back, you know, those old traditions, or like maybe I should ask my parents about, you know, why they came here, or like why we celebrate this. It's just, it's like there's something, it's joyous. I can't express it other than that. Yeah. It's like a celebration.
Well, I want to talk to both of you about some themes that I'm sure will overlap. I mean, I'm familiar with Malika's work because I'm holding the book right now. It's called I Was Their American Dream, a graphic memoir, and really worth finding, and I think for everybody, because it is a look at identity in a way that is, I think it's very sophisticated. I think it's very honest. I think it is really thoughtful about the ways that maybe teenagers think about it, and then sort of budding adults, and then adults in the working world. And I'd like to go through some of that with you, Malika. And then I think those same themes, I'm sure we can talk to Wynn about, because I'm sure there is a lot of overlap. Let's go back to your life growing up in California. You had, before your dad moved back to Egypt, your dad and your mom, who ended up getting divorced, were there. And you know, very different sort of cultural backgrounds with your mom and dad. Tell us about that.
Yeah, definitely. So my mom is Filipino Catholic and my dad is Egyptian Muslim. There's just so many rules and codes and like religious expressions, Tagalog expressions, Arabic expressions, the food is different. So like, for example, in Filipino culture, we eat with a spoon and fork. In Arabic culture, we eat with bread, or we use a fork and knife as a utensil. And then the stuff that we ate was so different, you know, like Filipinos eat sticky rice. Arabic people eat like sort of like a loose short grain rice. Obviously, there's no pork with Muslim people. And with Filipinos, like, I don't know if you've ever had Filipino food, but it's like a pork explosion. So that was really, really hard to sort of like, you know, my mom would be like, why aren't you eating your pork chops? And I'm like, I don't know, because dad's Muslim and he told me I shouldn't be eating pork because I might go to hell. You know, it's like really existential and horrible. And your soul is at stake. And, you know, in Arab culture, kids can, like, stay up all night until, like, midnight. And, you know, my mom was a little bit more traditionalist and was like, you're going to bed at 10 or whatever time made sense. And then also, like, the languages couldn't be any, they're so, so different. The Arabic, Egyptian Arabic that we speak is littered with Islamic expressions, like, you know, and there's lots of rules. So for example, you can't say like, your house is so beautiful. You can't say that. You can't just pay a compliment to someone because that would be like casting the evil eye upon them. So you would have to say, mashallah, thank God that your house is so beautiful. He has blessed you. And that sort of like takes the evil eye off of them. So there's a lot of like folk religious things to know as well. So just total landmines everywhere.
That is so interesting because, it's one thing just to be in high school and, you know, sort of navigate high school, you know, sort of norms of your school, maybe understanding cultural identity. It's another within your own household to maybe have a mom and dad with very different views on everything from what you eat to how you speak. And then all of a sudden, you know, you become this high school student who is thinking about it more because you're aware of I don't know if cliques is the right word, but you're aware of different cultural and identities of people at school. People are often asking, what are you? That was a very common question. Can you describe for listeners what that question was like for you in high school when people would ask, what are you?
Yeah, so this is a really controversial question. I learned this much later in life. I came from a place in the country where almost everyone was multicultural. So, like, it was a really, really important question to just establish, like, what ethnicity are you from? Are you Bangladeshi or are you Indian? Are you Indian or are you Pakistani? Are you from El Salvador? Or are you from Mexico? Are you from Mexico or are you from Honduras? These are really, really, really important distinctions because people care about, like, whether you know where, whether you get their ethnicity right. You don't want to confuse somebody who's from El Salvador with somebody from Honduras. They have totally different cultures, you know? Totally different things that they're proud about, totally different sports teams they're fanatic about, you know? But here on the, like, later in life, I learned, you know, that could be a question that othered people, that made people feel really different, especially if it was asked by a white person. But growing up, it was kind of like a really quick shorthand to, like, just get a sense of what a person's, you know, home life was or a person's upbringing was. So if you know that somebody is from Pakistan, they're maybe more likely to be Muslim and, you know, don't share your pepperoni pizza with them. You know, it's there's a lot of different things that you kind of pick up on in high school.
There's even a page in the book that I thought was fascinating where you explore just different reactions that people have when they are asked the question, what are you? And you kind of just explore the different ideas that people have about whether it's even appropriate. What I found really interesting was thinking about the way that question might land, depending on who is asking it. For example, if a white person is asking a person of color, what are you? It may land differently than if a person of color is asking a person of color. And sometimes it's the tone or the perceived intention of why a person wants to know. Take me through that.
Yeah, definitely. Like, if you're at a bar and it was, like, a guy and you're, like, a young woman and a guy was asking you, like, oh, what are you? Like, you know, that's kind of creepy, I would say. And then, you know, it's like, ew, get away from me. Or, you know, if it's, like, if you're the only person of color in your whole school and then people ask you that question constantly and you tell them and they still assume that you're Chinese if you're actually Vietnamese, like, that's super annoying. I think that, like, it's more important to come from, if you're asking, I think it's, culture is important. Like, people, that's, like, their identity. And I learned that in college. I missed being asked that question because people were really uncomfortable to talk about race. There's a fine line of, like, I guess that the intent, I think, of really wanting and to know and to be curious about what that person is and what that their culture might mean to them. I think that's how you can also avoid that tricky situation.
Yeah, and maybe tied to the question of what are you are the microaggressions bingo that you have a page on microaggressions bingo, all things that I'm sure you've heard a number of times. Do you mind if I read some and we can talk a little
bit
about
this?
You talk funny. You don't look Arab. Hablas Español.
Oh, God, I get that all the time.
Do you speak Egyptian? Where's your hijab? Do you speak Filipino? Why are Muslims terrorists? Were you born here? Can I just call you Molly?
I hate that.
Your English is great. You seem really white. You are so Americanized. And this one, I'm sure, is, I mean, I'm sure you hear this all the time. But I don't see color. So
yeah. There's
a lot. Those are just from the microaggressions bingo page that you have. The notion of microaggressions is occasionally gets mocked. But I think this page in its own way in this graphic novel, even in a partially humorous way, makes it very, very plain. I mean, I've never experienced anything like these. And there has to be a cumulative effect. Are there any on here that you hear more often or hit you harder?
Yeah, I would say that, first of all, I just want to say that, like, I never thought that, I always thought, like, no racism has ever happened to me, and because I never really thought about it. And then when I sat down to do these microaggressions bingo, I was like, let me try writing 5. And that list turned to, like, 50. I, like, had no idea that, like, all these things had been said to me. I kept, like, brushing it off, kind of like, the way a woman, if you get catcalled on the street, like, oh, it's like they're just men being men, you know? It's like you kind of like look the other way, and then finally I was like, wait, there's something wrong with this. This is like messed up. And I'm not going to stand for this any longer. Like, I'll start saying stuff now. But the thing that really bothers me, I think, is like, but you act so white. And it's like, that is really, really annoying to me, because I spent my whole life trying to be white, because that's how I thought you were supposed to be American. I couldn't just celebrate whatever my family's cultures were, because that in society, I was taught by my family, like, being yourself wouldn't allow you to succeed. You needed to know the way of the American world. So the fact that I present as white, you seem so white, it's like, well, it's because you, like, the society wouldn't allow me to be whatever myself was. Like, I had to sort of assimilate to fit in, and this is like a tragedy. I've lost my identity. It's like this whole existential question.
Hmm. Yeah, and so couple of things there, because I find it really interesting that, you know, you maybe had a moment in your life where you thought, well, I've never really experienced racism. And then you think about this. I am someone who thinks that intention does matter when we look at sort of how we're understanding on the scale of offense. I think intention does matter. But I also think at some point, you know, ignorance is not its own excuse. And so when you look at the bingo page that you have, things like "you are so exotic" can be really creepy and weird.
It's so creepy.
but at the center of all of this, you know, for example, "you are so Americanized," "you don't look Arab," "you seem really white." At the center of all of this is an expectation that what it means to be American is to be white. And you grew up, as you write in the book, seeing a media that was mostly white people covering mostly white stories, bands like Weezer, nothing wrong with Weezer, I'm a big fan, but, you know, there was this desire that you had in high school, but you also, in the culture of your high school, had to kind of navigate the idea that you could be accused of what, whitewashing, I think it was?
Yeah, being whitewashed.
Explain.
Yeah, there is like, you didn't want to be whitewashed either, because then that would make you, like, being whitewashed in California, in Southern California, you know, in like the early 2000s, meant that you were like trying really hard to be white. So like you were picking up skateboarding, like listening to like white music, which like Weezer, like rock music, Nirvana. And you were listening to the rock station, shopping at PacSun instead of like shopping. I don't know where else you would shop. I don't know, shopping, like skateboarding, all this stuff. So, you know, adopting this like surfer punk like style was seen as being whitewashed. And that, I think, also there's like no winning. Like the kids at school who are also people of color would like accuse you of being like too white, when like it's just, you know, like, so what am I supposed to do? Act like Filipino Egyptian? Like that's like you don't want me to be that either. So even amongst like people of color, there's like, yeah, I guess like grades of like how you should act and who you should be.
Yeah, and interestingly, then you go to Syracuse University. You go from California, first generation Filipino Egyptian American, going to Syracuse University, and you thought that the whole scene would look like the show Felicity, which it sort of did. It was really white. You said people didn't ask about, you know, what are you and your identity. And interestingly, you found yourself missing that because you were thinking about all the things that you liked about your cultural identity. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I definitely, that was like the biggest thing that I noticed. It's like, not only was everybody white, they were so uncomfortable and uninterested about talking about like race and identity. I mean, I didn't realize how much I was thinking or talking about it before in high school, but like, you know, I wanted to tell people that like, oh, I spend like every summer in Egypt, you know, my name means queen in Arabic. You know, like my family's Filipino, like we have this big celebrations around Christmas time and we've got this whole roasted pig. Like nobody cared. I also thought personally that being Filipino Egyptian was like so cool. And like nobody else thought that was cool. They're like, oh yeah, where's Egypt again? I'm like, oh my God, these people don't know anything. So I really, really missed that. And so I just felt like, I guess like here you don't talk about that. So I kind of just like didn't. And I was partially thinking of when I was writing this book, it's like, these are the things that I always wish that I could tell my white friends. Like, you have no idea about me when you don't ask. Like, my identity is everything. Like, you have no idea about who I am as a person if you don't ask or don't care about those things about me.
Yeah, and this is where I think, this is what I think the book is so thoughtful about. It, at least for me, and I'm going to be a little clumsy here, but, you know, I'm not as fluent as you are in talking about these issues. I mean, the book is phenomenal. And for me, those who are uncomfortable in talking about identity in this country, almost always, but not always, white people, they claim that, well, there's an obsession with identity. And one of the complaints that at least I think has potentially some merit is that if we're so invested in identity that we don't give individuals room to be anything other than what we ascribe to that identity, I could see that being a legitimate complaint. But then what we end up doing is sort of erasing the notion of culture and tradition and identity. And so you found yourself going from wanting to sort of be white and looking at this country thinking, well, that's what you have to be successful, to missing people even being interested at all. And then you end up, you get married, and you start to worry, can I cook the dishes that come out of this tradition anymore? Can I uphold some of these traditions? Am I going to lose them? And I find that all of this so thoughtful because you are obviously an individual. You were most unique in your high school. You know, you love all of the different aspects of your, you know, your religious and cultural traditions. But you're also, you know, someone who wants to be yourself. And I guess what I'm saying is I think you really split the difference nicely in a country that I think it's way too, I think, bifurcated between, well, identity politics is bad and we're too obsessed with it versus everything has to be identity first. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
So now that you are, you know, sort of looking back and you're thinking about these traditions, I laughed when you were trying to recreate dishes and you're calling family members. Are you feeling more comfortable now? Are you feeling like, look, it may not be perfect, but I care about it. I love it. I'm going to preserve as much as I can while, you know, knowing that, you know, sort of I am me. My husband Darren is Darren. You know, how do you view it?
Well, I think that when I realized that, like, oh my God, like, I've been wasting so much time trying to be white when I could have just, like, been learning from my grandma how to make these traditional dishes. And then maybe I would know so much more about being Filipino and Egyptian. Once you launch and graduate into, you know, graduate high school, you're, like, away from your family in college, you realize that, like, your education of your culture, that's all you get with your family. Like, then when you're on your own in your 20s, you get married, you start your own life. Everything that you know in your mind, that's it. That's, like, that's all you get. Well, of course, I can call my mom, I guess, any time. But, like, I just wish I spent more time, like learning about that stuff, learning about traditions and songs and our history. But now I realize I live in Nashville, Tennessee, where there's very few Filipino people here. There's only 1,000 Filipinos in the entire Davidson County area, which is the metro area of Nashville. And you have to seek community. You have to find it and you have to make it. Like, it takes effort. Like, if you want to find traditional dishes, find people to celebrate Christmas with, like, you need to find that on your own. You have to do the work. It's just not going to come naturally to you the way that you can just go to your mom's house and, like, you know, have the big roasted pig. You got to make an effort. And that's what I learned, I guess, living on my own.
You also write that that you had such affection for different aspects of your two parents' religions, Catholicism and Islam. And there were aspects of both that were natural and beautiful to you. How, as an adult now, how do you, you know, sort of reconcile and see religion and, you know, maybe think about how different your parents were, but how much value you might get out of both?
Yeah, I remember when I was young, religion meant everything to my parents. Like, it was so important. It was the pomp and circumstance of both religions. They're, you know, in Catholicism and Islam, they're very similar in that there are so many rules and regulations and like celebrations and, you know, the Eucharist and then like praying 5 times a day. There's a lot of regimented activities. And I actually found a lot of calm and beauty in how ancient those rituals were. I found that to be deeply formal and deeply beautiful. and feel very proud to be associated with those religions at all. I think that it really, I would say, my dad used to say, you know, without religion, man has no direction. I think he probably meant like moral direction. And I think that is also the same with Catholicism as well. Like that's basically the same. Catholicism gives you a way to live your life and a way to live your spiritual life. And I'm glad that meant both to my parents. Now as an adult, you know, it's very hard to grow up with two religions. It's very hard for me to accept that Jesus is, you know, the one true God, because Muslims think that there's only one God, and that is in the Catholic religion, God the Father. So it's like, it's hard to marry all of those tenets together. That's impossible to do. So I don't know. It's a work in progress. It's very complicated. If anybody who you talk to who comes from a two religious household, it's like, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, yeah. And in a moment, I'm going to turn the spotlight on Wynn and talk about some of these issues of identity as he sees them. Before that, let me just get a couple of listener comments, feedback here. Mike says, Evan, I've been to Baguio City, Philippines, a dozen times for my job in the past 11 years. They are the most hospitable people. I never feel or sense racism while I was there. It helped me recognize and connect with ethnic Filipinos back here at home. Great.
Aww.
Great stuff. Thank you, Mike. And John in Rochester on the phone wants to weigh in, too. Go ahead, John.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Thanks so much. I mean, I'm a middle-aged white guy. But the discussion really helps me feel less alone, because I grew up, you know, in the suburbs here outside Rochester, and I just never fit. You know, I couldn't assimilate very well. And my whole family, most of them are just, you know, very, you know, by the rules of whatever that is in America. I grew up, you know, Irish Catholic. I didn't do well in school. I remember my mom telling me when I was maybe six, you know, my grades would go up and down. I wasn't doing the work. And she'd say, well, where's your Protestant work ethic? And I never heard that before. It's like I'm being sent to a Catholic school. And I wasn't good in school for other reasons, you know, not that. This is back in the 60s, so... but since then, you know, like my sister's in a mixed marriage. One of my daughters is married to a Vietnamese guy. He's half Vietnamese, so you kind of got to see he's half white and trying to belong in a full Vietnamese family. And there's some, you know, issues there. But I guess I just... I would say to anyone who's coming here, and I really, really am thrilled to meet people from all around the world, is, you know, you don't have to assimilate. You don't have to do the, toe the line stuff, and don't be afraid to speak out. I mean, that's like what I tell my three daughters, you know, I'm just such an iconoclast ever since I can remember. I never really did get the... I thought it was Halloween in Catholicism when I first saw the statues and, you know, the human sacrifice. And I found out I'm an atheist, but I love some things I found, like sayings by Rumi. I like the I Corinthians 13 poem on love. And I'll leave you with this. Have you ever heard of Gia Tolentino?
Yeah.
For the New Yorker. So thanks. Thank you so much, you too. Yeah, I'd love to meet you sometime.
All right, John, thank you. Malika, thank you want to respond? Go ahead, Malika.
Oh, that's so nice. It's wonderful that you come from a blended family. And actually, the idea that you felt like an outsider growing up, I mean, that's like the sub theme of the book, too. It's you don't really need to be a person of color to relate to the book. It's about trying to fit in when you don't feel like you fit in. And realizing, hey, there's nothing wrong with being yourself, and you should be yourself if you want to. And that is the beauty of America, to be able to feel like you belong.
talking to Malika Gharib, the author of I Was Their American Dream, a graphic memoir out now in a beautiful and thoughtful book, beautifully illustrated too. And it's fun. I mean, it's an amazing story because, you know, if you haven't picked up a graphic novel in a while, you'll be probably amazed at how fast you move through it. But there is a lot of depth to the material there, a very thoughtful graphic memoir. Let's take our only break. We're going to come back with Malika. And Nguyen Khoi Nguyen is with us, who is the author of The Gulf and Bittersweet, a pandemic sketchbook, and a digital media lecture at Loyola University of Maryland. We're going to talk to Nguyen about some of the same themes we've been talking about with Malika, about identity and more. We'll take more of your questions and comments, if you like, as well, on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. World AIDS Day 2020 is very different this year. Dr. Bill Valenti joins us to talk about how the pandemic has impacted the fight against AIDS worldwide. In our second hour on Tuesday, when it comes to anti-racism efforts, Indigenous people sometimes feel left out. Why is that? What might change it? We'll talk about all of that and more with you on Connections on Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Nguyen, you heard Malika describe growing up and hearing the question, what are you, often, especially in high school? It's a question that seemed to go away when she was in mostly white settings in college and the working world. How do you view that question, and how often have you heard it?
Yeah, so it's funny how that question keeps coming up, but it's people word it differently now. You know, now mostly I get, you know, what is your background, or like what is your cultural background, and I'm always happy to answer that. When I was a kid, yeah, from adults, I lived in a town that was kind of the opposite of what Malik experienced. So this was in Florida in the 80s, and there were no other Vietnamese families in my town. I think growing up, maybe there was like one Filipino family, and maybe like one Chinese family. You know, it was very limited. So as a kid, we definitely were just wanted to fit in, wanted to be as white as possible, and we didn't. It wasn't a conscious thing. It just that's just how the kind of paradigm hung all around us. So when I didn't start to think about identity or who I was until college, you know, when you're trying to make art that says something, you know, and what do you have to say? You go back to your roots and you go back to thinking about what matters to you. And that's when I started to realize, you know, my Vietnamese identity is probably what matters to me the most, you know, what my parents taught me. And at that point, I had never even gone back to Vietnam. So it was a lot of searching and researching and seeking out community, like Malika said, too, just trying to find anybody that was Vietnamese. I went to college in New York City, and you know, I could go to Chinatown and there would be like one or two Vietnamese restaurants, and just like sitting there having a bowl of pho was like, I remember being really homesick and thinking, you know, my work has to be about this somehow. I have to, you know, learn how to learn about Vietnamese painters and maybe find my way into that world, or, you know, say something about how I grew up.
So, let me read an email, if I could, and I'd love to get your take on it. Pull back up here. Charles says, Evan, I feel like this puts us in a little bit of a hard box as white people. He said, I'm not laughing. I'll read it, Charles. Go ahead, and we'll let when we respond here. Charles says, we're not supposed to ask what people are, because that can be offensive or, as your guests say, creepy. But if we don't ask, it shows that we don't have any interest in their culture. What are we supposed to do? Okay, Nguyen, go ahead.
Well, I would say that definitely don't lead with that question. You know, don't let that be the first question, you know. Ask us. I think this is just social etiquette and being a good conversationalist, right? Is listening, being observant about the person you're talking to, and when I'm meeting anybody, I would rather just know like what excites you right now in your life first before I go into the, can you tell me about your cultural background?
Okay, Mala, could you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's a really great way of putting it. And like, they might like hint, it's like, oh yeah, like my family used to do stuff like that all the time. Mm-hmm. Like we're Filipinos, so it's like, oh, you're Filipino. Like, tell me more about that. Like just casual,
Okay. Well, Nguyen, let's talk a little bit more about how you view that question of identity these days. And frankly, whether you think as a society we're getting any more sophisticated and better about sort of working through it and dealing with it, because sometimes to me it feels stagnant and it feels sort of intractable, whether that's tied to politics or not. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm being sort of myopic here. Do you feel that we're becoming a little bit more sophisticated about the way we interact with one another and the way we talk about identity and consider identity?
That's really tough to answer. I think that immigrant communities are reaching out to one another more. I think there is a solidarity that I've been seeing since the protests that happened this past summer between immigrant communities. I mean, we look at the Black community and see all of the issues that they are going through, and we identify with that racism, that structural racism that we all experience, and we want to be a part of that fight. On the other hand, I think the past 4 years have really exposed how divided we still are, how racist this country still is. And so there's so much work to be done. I have a bunch of really wonderful colleagues at Loyola, and this whole semester we've been doing this experimental gallery online, and it's all about the topic of representation, and identity is a big part of that. And so there are visual arts students, there are kids in my class that are doing comics, there are writing students, and we're all working together to try to make work about these really difficult topics that our country is facing. And so it's kind of swirling around in my head a lot. For me, it's being much more political than I've ever been in my own work, talking about issues of racism in my work that is usually not explicit, but I think it's really important right now.
All right, let me get Stephen Brighton, who wants to follow up on a point we were just talking about. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Evan. This is a great topic. I'm an old man now, and I have traveled all over the world, and I love other cultures. And I guess my traveling is through Netflix now, but I have always wanted to meet people and ask them about where they're from and how it's different from where I'm from. I don't have any ulterior motive from it, but I've been told, I used to live in the very liberal Boulder, Colorado, and I've been told by people there and ever since, oh, you can never ask people where they're from because it's racist. You're pointing out that they're different. And I don't mean to do that. Okay. On the other hand, people will say, well, you don't understand because you're white and you live in America. Well, I have to tell you, I do understand because I'm a Southerner living in the North. So there's never a point where you meet someone new where you're not asked if you married your cousin, or if you've had your weekly bath, or so on and so on and so on. So I do understand it, but it's a dilemma, and I suppose I have to respect, I have to respect that I could be insulting someone. I don't mean to, but I tend to ask them about their culture and where they're from right off the bat. Okay. Mm. I mean,
And I wanted to point that out. Today I'm working on a job and they had a maintenance man from Puerto Rico. And I asked him, you think Puerto Rico ought to be a state? And he looked at me like, I ain't going there. Okay, well, I didn't have an ulterior motive, but you know what? I kind of admired him for that because he had no idea if I had a motive or not. Anyway, I just wanted to make that comment, okay?
Yeah, Steve, always appreciate the call. Okay, thank you very much.
Right.
We'll ask both of our guests. And when you were, I think this is probably an extension of the email from Charles that you were responding to, which is you think maybe leading with that kind of question is a little blunt or maybe clumsy or not. Not advisable, but is there more you want to add for Steve here?
Yeah, I think it just comes down to, have you already established trust? I mean, for us, I think in you know, racism towards immigrant communities is on the rise, right? So we're not going to just be vulnerable with you immediately. You know, we have to be a little more vigilant. So if you've established trust with the person you're talking to, then maybe you can start to ask about those identity questions.
Okay, Malakim?
Yeah, I would also say, too, that, like, you know, just even talking about your own experience with other cultures is also, like, a great, like, icebreaker, too. You can say, like, oh, like I've like traveled, you know, many parts of the world. And one of my favorite things to do is to like, you know, like eat new foods and try new things and, you know, to share a little bit about yourself also.
Yeah.
I think that helps a lot.
I also want to follow this up, Malika, by highlighting a part of your book in which one of the responses to the question of what are you? Someone might say, I'm American, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
And so I bring that up because, you know, I don't know Steve all that well personally. He calls the show and he's been on the show and he's, I think a very sweet and thoughtful person. And clearly, at least pretty clear to me that Steve's intention in learning about people is because he thinks difference is beautiful and interesting. And that's, mm-hmm. that's a wonderful cornerstone for building a multicultural society is taking that disposition and really meaning it and understanding and being open to it. As opposed to treating difference like talking to someone, you know, like we're in sort of the circus or something. But I think Steve views it that way in really the sincere, I want to learn more about the world. I think it's beautiful. But if you ask somebody, what are you or where are you from? And they are, whether it's first generation or not, American, it implies, or it could imply, especially if there's not that trust, as Wynn was talking about, that, you know, whatever you are is not American or not American enough. Can you just say a little bit about that, Malika?
Sure. Like, I guess if somebody responds, like, what, you know, what's your ethnic background? And you can say, and if they say, like, I'm from America, you probably offended them. You should probably just drop it. That's what I think.
Have you said that before in response to someone?
No, I haven't said that because I think, like, you know, 8 times out of 10 in my experience, like, people seem really genuine when they ask you, you know, what your ethnic background is, what are you? And, like, I really like, breaking stereotypes of, what did you expect? You, like, my father's from Egypt and is Muslim. Did you expect me to look, like, I don't know, like, different? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like a punk-loving, skateboarding, you know, teenager. You know, I wasn't, like, I don't know what they were expecting, but I usually like to break stereotypes that way.
Okay. And Wynn, how do you feel about that, the idea that that question might imply that someone is not American?
Yeah. I mean, I'm grateful that I haven't directly, I don't think, experienced racism in the past, I don't know, since the pandemic has gone on, but I've been reading stories about people who are just being, you know, hurled racist comments like, you know, you don't belong here, or, you know, they'll say things like that. And I think that's, I think you're totally justified to respond to say like, hey, I'm as American as you are. You know, I grew up in New Jersey. You know, I'm from New Jersey. I'm just as American as you are. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge with, well, you know, you can think of it as a challenge, but I also think it's a strength that Malika and I and first generation immigrants, I mean, we can navigate several different worlds at once. And I can be really, really proud of being an American, and I can be really, really proud of being Vietnamese. And that's a good thing on most days.
All right. Well, before I let you go, and when I got to ask you, when's the Gulf coming?
Oh man. well, I've got winter break coming up. finals will be done soon, so I'll have a chapter out soon enough.
Okay, 5 chapters in 7 years. I'm just saying. Wynn is the author of The Gulf, which will get to us eventually, and Bittersweet, a pandemic sketchbook, and a digital media lecture at Loyola University of Maryland. Thank you. Thanks for making time for the program and sharing your experience with us.
Thanks so much, and it's great to talk to you, Evan, and always great to talk to you, Malika.
Always great to talk to you, Wynn.
Malika Gharib is the author of I Was Their American Dream, and it's a book that's out, and it does, I'm sure, make a great gift. But it's just great for anyone to pick up and read. I don't need to sell this for you. I'm not your agent, but it's really beautiful. Malika, congratulations on it, and thank you for it. I think we're all better for having read it, and thanks for making time for the program today.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's Malika Gharib. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon on this, well, dreary outside. Maybe not inside. And we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.